You're listening to The Printcast, a podcast about the expanding world of printmaking. The Printcast is an inky finger on the pulse of what's happening in print today. I'm your host, Nick Naughton. Kathy Caraccio is a master printer who I met years ago when I was teaching adjunct print courses at the Kansas City Art Institute. The Nelson Atkins Museum of Art was showing an exhibit of Romare Bearden prints, which were amazing, by the way, and they brought Kathy in from New York for some programming related to the show because she was a printer who worked on some of his early prints. She's a master of viscosity printing, collagraph, color, and all kinds of things. So she was excellent to see in person and to learn from and to learn about her process, which is something we're going to hear about today. More recently in 2019, I had Kathy come join me at the IFPDA Print Fair, where we attempted to record a live interview. If you remember from earlier in the series of the show, I was invited to do some recording live, and so I did some of their interviews, and then I recorded some of my own. And what was supposed to be just like a nice sit down where we were going to like tell Kathy's stories and like talk about all of her history became this raucous, interactive conversation between Kathy and myself and a whole bunch of unsuspecting students who just happened to be sitting in the chairs near the stage. They weren't actually there to watch us. But immediately upon starting, Kathy saw them floundering around and sitting there, and she beckoned them all to the stage. And it ended up being this like hilarious good time. But unfortunately, it wasn't something I could share here on the podcast because it was just like all over the place and it wasn't cohesive. And so I invited Kathy on again in 2020 last fall so that we could like truly capture her stories and give it the attention and the time it deserved. And so that's what I'm bringing you today. Kathy Caraccio is a master printer who started out working under Arun Bose at Hunter College. And then she spent 4 years printing and absorbing all kinds of knowledge at Robert Blackburn's print workshop, where she worked for 4 years being what she called the studio mom. And then she opened her own studio, which she's been running for the past 42 years. Kathy is an artist, master printer, collector of prints, and we talk about all these things, some of the trips she took, and many of the artists she's known over the years and worked with. Today's Let's Get Technical is all about collagraph, which I'm excited to share. So make sure you listen to the end of the show for some priceless tips about that from the master herself. She kind of gives a good breakdown on like what a good collagraph is, how to start with a foundation of materials to create one, a few things to look out for, etc. In a way, this interview dovetails really nicely with my previous episode with Phil Sanders. Some of the same people come up, some of the same prints like Robert Rauschenberg's accident print. So you can connect some of the historical dots today with some of the previous shows you've heard. Speaking of Phil Sanders, though, he started his book club relating to his book Prints and Their Makers. He mentioned that in the previous episode of the show. And I wanted to let you know that there are 5 more episodes coming up and that you can actually watch the old recordings on Zoom if you're wanting to catch up also. The one that happened last night was the first iteration of his series, and it was phenomenal. It was like you get to see behind the scenes. You can actually fire off live questions. And so like I got a couple questions answered that just popped into my head like on the day of. It was incredible. You can pay what you want or you cannot pay at all. Phil is very generous with his time and with his knowledge. And it's just like something I wouldn't miss if you're like a true printmaker. So check it out. You can see it on Phil Sanders' Instagram feed, and you'll see everything you need to know for the next iteration that's coming up soon. Also, one more thing, I have a quick announcement from Self Help Graphics, which is a nonprofit arts organization here in Los Angeles. They're actually hiring for a master printer. So they've been open since 1973. Their organization supports the advancement of Chicana, Chicano, and Latinx artists by offering classes, community engagement, programs for the public, studio rental. Really a phenomenal organization, and I have a big amount of respect for them. The master printer position is open right now for applications, and it's a great opportunity for anyone looking to be a master printmaker, screen print in particular, in the LA area. You can even relocate, and they've got funding allocated for that if need be. So I would recommend anyone who thinks they'd have the right skills for this job to apply at selfhelpgraphics.com/opportunities. Also, another note from Self Help Graphics, they have a biennial print summit coming up in March of this year on 10th, 11th, and 12th of March. Happening on Zoom this year, and unfortunately we can't all get together in person, you can tune in and engage from the comfort of your own home, and you might see demos, lectures. 2 years ago, Allison Zarr was, I think, the keynote speaker, so that was like really cool. And it's a really intimate kind of thing, and Self Help Graphics is all about community engagement, empowerment of people. So it's really something great, and I would encourage you to check that out. It's happening on Zoom, so find out more info at selfhelpgraphics.com. Thanks for listening to all these announcements, and feel free to send yours to info@theprintcast.com, or you can DM me on my Instagram because I check that too. The Printcast is a listener-supported podcast, so you can support the show by sharing about it, and you can leave reviews on iTunes. That's always helpful too for people to find the show. And you can join my crew of financial backers on Patreon if that's something that works for you too. I've updated my tiers of support, so now there's more than just like a cup of coffee level. There's three different levels. One of them, you can get a shout out here on the show. You can receive stickers or a postcard from the show. And the postcard is kind of made of like make ready test prints that I do for screen printing. So like they're kind of these wacky, cool art prints. Very cool. You can also collect hand carved woodcut prints that I carve here in my LA studio. So you can check out all of that at patreon.com/theprintcast. And thanks for tuning in, everyone. Without further ado, Kathy Caraccio.
And the teacher, Arun, from his Indian culture, stayed with me as long as I wanted to work. So we could be there till midnight, and he would be there with me.
Wow.
He would not leave the room with me still in it. And that kind of teaching and dedication and heartfelt understanding, he loved what he did, and he transferred that into the printmaking. So his first demo for his first class at this, he was Hunter at the time, was, what do you know about viscosity? And we all went, we don't know what printmaking is. And he said, let me show you. And he pulled out the rollers and he did a viscosity demonstration, and I was his. That was it. That was like, holy moly, I am so lucky to be in the path of something of this import, that I found a mentor who treated me like an artist. I hadn't realized I was a student until he talked to me like I was a peer. He'd talk about collections. And so when I graduated, I said, what do I do? I want to come back and use the press. He said, no, go to Blackburns. And so again, the pathway was set up for me to be in an international community of people who wanted to invest in their hands and make printmaking, a totally analog world at the time.
You're listening to The Printcast, Season 2, for sophisticated arty types.
New York has long been a hotspot for print shops, employing master printers to usher masterful prints into the world. And today's guest has been working for 43 years, bringing her own unique flair to collaboration and printmaking. Kathy Caraccio opened her shop in 1977 after being what she says the studio mom at Robert Blackburn's print studio for 4 years. Ever since that time, she's kept her press running, mentored hundreds of young artists, and collected over 6,000 print works by some names you might recognize, like Romare Bearden, Ed Clark, Louise Nevelson, Emma Amos, Mel Bachner, and Saul LeWitt, to name a few. Kathy is a professor, mentor, master printer, and artist. She practices color intaglio, viscosity printing, calligraph with silk aquatint, paper making, and Japanese Hanga-style woodcut printing, and she's long been a proponent of green studio practices. Kathy has taught printmaking at NYU, Columbia University, Parsons New School, Pratt, and currently at the National Academy. Her prints can be found in the collections of the Metropolitan Museum of Art, the Library of Congress, the Portland Art Museum, the Achenbach Foundation for the Graphic Arts, the Fine Museum of California, and the New York Public Library, as well as the Jane Voorhees Zimmerli Art Museum. Kathy Caraccio, welcome to the Printcast.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be here.
It's great to have you on. So with such a long career, I wanted to start in the beginning and figure out, you know, what was your young life like and how did you end up going into art of all things as a young woman in the 60s and 70s?
I am my mother's daughter, and I learned to sew before I learned to talk. And so I made all my own clothes. I was a craftsperson. I was a DIY from the beginning. And so going to school, when I hit the printmaking, it was clear to me I could use my hands. I could think through my hands. And I was also paired up with a wonderful teacher, Arun Bose, who was at Hayter Studio. And then he came to New York and became my teacher. He was a sabbatical replacement. So it was one of those fortunate, I was going to be working with Richard Zeman, a wonderful engraver from Yale, and he went on sabbatical, and Arun Bose became my mainstay teacher. I didn't go to any of the classes once I hit Arun Bose, because he treated me like an artist. He talk to me like I was an artist in the streets of Paris. He'd say, let's go get some wine. Let's go get some cheese. I'd be like, that's not appropriate in this school. I was at Hunter College, but it was the Uptown campus, which turned into Lehman College. And at that time, the Bronx was in big transition, and Lehman College was their way to go bilingual and open the doors to all the citizens that came into the Bronx. So I had that early influx of an awareness of community that was in the demographic was changing. And one of my students, whose name is Betty Perez, who's still making prints, said, let's go visit Maria Somoza. And I said, why are we visiting Maria Somoza? Who is she? Well, she wrote a grant to open a small press at El Museo del Barrio and teach printmaking in Spanish. I took Spanish in high school. Let's see if I can do printmaking in another language. And it's free. It was a grant. So I started right away with an interest in the multicultural layers of what printmaking had to offer because of what she brought to it. She did everything in Spanish. I didn't understand most of it. She thought I spoke Spanish because I could get by, but I didn't understand her critiques. And she became the director of the Institute of Puerto Rican Culture, and she invited me to the Caribbean Biennial. She gave me a show at the Institute and gave classes at the university in El San Juan and met the artists there. I was a dignitary because she invited me in. I was still in college. It was 1969, so we're way back. And minimalism is what's being taught in the painting department. And I really could care less to build a picture out of colorated paper, which is the way they were doing it. And I just found myself in the print room using my hands, access to the acid. The door never closed. They didn't lock the room. And the teacher, Arun, from his Indian culture, stayed with me as long as I wanted to work. So we could be there till midnight. And he would be there with me.
Wow.
He would not leave the room with me still in it. And that kind of teaching and dedication and heartfelt understanding, he loved what he did, and he transferred that into the printmaking. So his first demo for his first class at this, it was Hunter at the time, was, what do you know about viscosity? And we all went, we don't know what printmaking is. And he said, let me show you. And he pulled out the rollers and he did a viscosity demonstration, and I was his. That was it. That was like, holy moly, I am so lucky to be in the path of something of this import that I found a mentor who treated me like an artist. I hadn't realized I was a student until he talked to me like I was a peer. He'd talk about collections. And so when I graduated, I said, what do? I want to come back and use the press. He said, no, go to Blackburn's. And so, again, the pathway was set up for me to be in an international community of people who wanted to invest in their hands and make printmaking, a totally analog world at the time. Wherever there was photo being done, I stayed away from it.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't a skill that I had. An affinity for.
Now, getting into working at Robert Blackburn's studio, like, I have a friend named Brett Thompson who was there probably many, many years later after you, and he had worked there for a long time. But his story was very similar to yours in that I think when he was telling me, he was like, I went and visited and met everybody, and then I got on an elevator and was going down the elevator, and this guy standing next to me started talking to me, and we started like chatting, and I told him what I did. And it turned out it was Robert Blackburn he was standing next to, and I don't think he knew or something. And he basically on the spot was like, oh, you should come print for me, because Brett had just done a bunch of time in Japan. So he came back and ended up printing relief, you know, for like Elizabeth Catlett and all these people. Like, he ended up one day coming into, I knew Brett in grad school, but he came in and brought in a big stack of prints, and it was like a copy of every single Elizabeth Catlett print that exists. Because she'd come in and just dropped off all the blocks, and he ran editions of all of them for her for some event or affair.
I'm jealous.
Yeah, and it was something where I was just like, wow, who is this guy? Where is this print shop? And I, you know, that was my first exposure to him and what he had done. But you were with that studio like way more in the earlier years. So can we talk about like who was Robert Blackburn and like what was his significance at that time in kind of like the 70s era of printing in New York, and what did he do and how did his shop function?
He was a student of a woman teacher named Riva Halfont. And she influenced him in being witnessed as an artist. And he was a beautiful draftsman. And he did social realism images when he started. And he wanted to do lithography. I guess he had a taste for it from school. I don't know quite where he found lithography. But he eventually worked for Tatiana Grossman at Universal Artists Limited Edition. And he printed for famous people. Jasper Johns was, they were all kids. Jasper Johns, Roy Lichtenstein, there was a whole crew that came through there. And Bob did the famous Broken Stone. I don't know if you know this piece. And in his mind, that meant he was going to be fired because it was a giant stone. And it crazed the length of the stone. And Rauschenberg said, no, it's perfect. Print it. Well, do you know how hard it is to print a broken stone? Apparently, it's just like a nightmare.
It's like a nightmare. Yeah, I've heard horror stories.
But he got, I heard this, Phil Saunders spoke about it at the print fair in October last year. I think he got something like 29 or 39 prints off the broken stone. And it's called the Broken Stone. It's a very famous, iconic kind of bit. And I think about Bob being in service as a lithographer, how dutiful he was and how hardworking he was. He was clearly one of the hardest working people that I've ever known. But when he started his workshop, he wanted it to be available to everybody. He wanted to be, you came in, you didn't have to, if you couldn't afford the rent, just come in and work. He'd always say, just get to work. He wouldn't worry. You can be a monitor. The transit of money was an unfortunate in terms of his business practice. He wanted it to be an open workshop, egalitarian, open to everybody. And Bob wasn't charging anybody rent. He was working on grants. There was a rental fee. I paid rent for 1 month. And then he needed someone to type letters for him. So I was like, I used to be a secretary. I'll type letters. But I said, Bob, I'm paying rent to do that. He said, no, you're the monitor now. You'll be the monitor. My press was next to a payphone, which was not his desk phone. And the phone rang. And I said, should I get it? Okay, got the phone. And it turned out to be Lee Friedlander, who is a famous photographic artist, and he wanted to emboss handmade paper from Fabriano Mill so that they could mount photographs on it. And so he had 15 different artists, Bravo, he had this list of the top names of photography, Walker Evans, everybody was in this portfolio, but each one had a different size plate. So we had to emboss this paper to the size of the image that he needed. So we had 15 different plates and we're going to do an addition of, I think, 50 each. So we got this huge shipment of Fabriano paper and embossed it. So that was my first job. But when I picked up the phone, I said, it's Lee Friedlander with the job. He said, well, write things down and, find out what the details are. So I made a few notes and then I went to Bob and he said, okay, you bid the job and don't overbid it. I don't want to lose it. I said, I don't do this. I'm here doing my own artwork. He said, it's embossment. You know how to emboss. You can do this job. Go ahead. Just don't bid too high. So I said, okay, 50 cents a plate. And Lee was like, great. And I proceeded to, get my feet wet in production, which I love. I love production because I'm a seamstress. I'm a crochet. I'm a knit. I know how to do the kind of tedious, continuous flow of something that has to be accurate because you can't lose a stitch. And I did 1,500 embossments, which had its own nightmare because it was we wet the paper and it was too humid and everything mildewed. And I had to order paper from Fabriano at my own expense to recoup the lost paper. There was a learning curve there. And the learning curve was, it's only money. Nobody's bleeding. Nobody's hurt. I'm nobody's surgeon. you know, nobody's cut. It's just a matter of money and I can buy more paper and cover my arse.
Well, then, so as you were there for a while, I love how you told me about how you got printing for Romare Bearden, and what a happenstance thing it was. This is the thing that blows my mind, is just how I don't know how you just kind of seem to have fallen into all these opportunities and things. And I guess in a way it still happens that way in this world we live in, but it always seems like the art world of like the 60s, 70s, 50s in New York was like such a place where there wasn't that many people there. And there were like all these great people just walking around and working together and lots of fiery energy. And like, but anyway, like how, can you tell the story of like how you started printing for Bearden Prints and just how that all came about?
So my own printing practice was, Arun told me his advice was that we're all the same. Everybody gets up in the morning, uses the bathroom, and proceeds with their life. Nobody is special. We're all the same human being endeavoring to get through a day. So he leveled the playing field. He basically cut out the hierarchy of somebody's higher and somebody's lower. He also loved color. He loved color. His artwork was sumptuously beautiful. He loved color. And who doesn't want to fall in love with color? It's so easy. It's really, you know, when I hear people say that now, oh, I love color. And I'm thinking, of course you love color. Who doesn't love color? Who's like, I only like black and white? It doesn't happen. So I took off on the viscosity issue because we had rollers at school, and then ran to Blackburn's and boom, full of rollers, all kinds of rollers. So I had some plates that I had proofed in college that I wanted to see if could I addition. And I started putting out, he had lots of slabs. There was marble, there was glass. There were a lot of surfaces that I could work on. It was makeshift, but, you know, you just cleaned it up and you did the rollers. And I had a full 3-roller color viscosity set up. And Bob came by with a big plate that he had made. Romare Bearden had collaged from a photo, negative or positive, I don't know what they photographed with, a transparency. Mm-hmm. And had collaged a prior collage that he had photographed, and then he recollaged it in different types of screens. So there were mesotone screens and linear screens and fine dot and large dot. And so the collage was a collage of photographic elements. So it was true to working within the photo medium, even though it wasn't just a photo of a collage. It was remanipulated. So Bob brings this big plate and he says, I'd like you to roll some color on this. And I'm like, I'm printing here. Like, it's my setup. What color do you want? And he said, no, the colors you have out, those are good. And I said, who is this artist? What is this? You know, he said, it doesn't matter. Just, I'd like you to roll some ink on these and get your color onto them. And I'm like, where's this going? What's going on? And he said, I'll pay you for 2 days. Just ink this thing up as many times as you can in as many different ways. Just go for it. And it turned out it was a plate that went for publication. That was Romare Bearden's. And the prints, I think 10, 12 prints came out of those 2 days. They went to Romy. Romy then watercolored on them to fix them from my printing. So it wasn't a verbal, there was no communication. It was like, I did the starter kit. Romy did the next layer. He did the starter kit. I did the color viscosity on it. And then the process was gone back to Romy. He watercolored them. Then it went to the publisher and the publisher said, let's do 250 of this one. 250. Bob came back to me and he said, we need 250 of this print. I'm like, I wasn't proofing. You just had me roll color. I didn't keep records. I didn't know I was doing an addition. I hadn't that practice yet, but I can shift. I can change. I can grow. And I thought, this is money in the bank. Okay. I can make some money.
Did you then have to?
How to make that an addition. I had to cut the plates. I had to engrave some things off. I had to add the aqua tint that would do the watercolor.
Okay. Yeah. I was wondering, like, how, if you had to quantify the watercolor on your side.
I will say Arun Bose was so graceful technically. It wasn't like Lisansky had a whole kind of hater-esque learn engraving. There was a whole kind of proper approach. British. It was a very British proper approach to printmaking. Arun was like, let's reinvent the wheel. He had a sandblaster working to make mezzotint plates. I'm like, what? And he was working on steel. What? He was working on steel. No one was working on steel. No place in the United States do I know anybody was working on steel. And so it was like, he just, any door you wanted to open, you would go there, you'd call Arun, he'd say, okay, blah, 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 look at this, try that. He was miraculous. So he basically gave carte blanche. You can do anything you can think of. If you can go to sleep in the middle of the night, it'll come to you. You wake up in the morning, you're ready to go. And I do that now. If I need to solve a problem, I dream solve it. I wake up in the morning with the answer. It's all I got.
No, so that's fortunate if it works like that.
It does. Try it.
So then, so being a young woman, like at that time in the 70s, like working there, like what was it like as a woman, like working as a printer? Like what was your experience just in the art world? Because it always seems like such a male dominant art world back then, like what the Guerrilla Girls were pointing out and all these things. What was it like for you? What was your experience?
I think the marketplace has its foibles with male, female, and money and that whole kind of hierarchy. In the print shop, I have an Irish heritage. My maiden name is Donnelly. I am a worker bee. When you're willing to work and stay up all night and get the job done and stand by your work, that's how you're witnessed, male or female. The people could call on me. I was trustworthy. I actually didn't really distinguish so much I could see the men love the presses. And I wasn't so much a pressophile. I liked that the press worked and it was kept clean and all of that. But I didn't want to know how to take it apart and put it back together again. It didn't fascinate me. It was a machine that worked for me. I remember a lot of the printers were women. There were a lot of women in the shop. I think who's available in the afternoon? It's mostly women. Really?
Interesting. Yeah.
And I think in my education, it was in printmaking, it was mostly women. And Arun loved the women. He just brought a love to everything he did. It was an amazing possibility to have a mentor in my life, like Arun, from a totally different culture. So, I remember they had an editioning room. Bob Kale was a printer who studied at Haters. I think he studied at Haters. There was a lot of viscosity going on. There were a lot of rainbow roll, that kind of gradient roll was very popular in the shop because there were rollers and we were all kind of rolling up stuff. So that kind of understanding relief printing on metal was what was happening. So then the Ed Clarks are relief printed on metal. So you take an engine and you print it instead of a woodcut.
Interesting.
I don't remember too many woodcuts going on. And Bob was the lithographer. He was really, he printed the lithos. He was printing lithos. That first studio on 23rd Street, he took a second floor. And on the second floor, he put the collection. And he built a little additioning room. So when the Bearden job came in, there was money, there was cash flow to sequester that room. And so I was in a private room with a 6-foot wall. And on the other side of that wall was the collection. And Bob would bring people into the collection room and talk about the prints. I couldn't see them because I was working, but I could hear about them. And that was the seed set for collecting.
Interesting.
I would go to Bob and say, you were amazing. Your stories are amazing. I want to see the print. Show them to me. He'd be like, no, 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 no. He would never show them to me. He wasn't a bean counter. He was storyteller. When he showed his prints, he'd tell the stories about how he got to his prints, but he didn't do that for the public. He wouldn't have an audience. He'd have a one person that he'd treat him to that.
Interesting. So like, at a certain point, I mean, from gleaning all this knowledge and like being in a very active studio, you learned a ton of stuff. And so what, after about 4 years, you launched your own studio. What was that like? Like what, how'd you get started? Like, how'd you get a press and things like that?
Okay. Being in a not-for-profit situation, they're fraught with, they have to write grants. They have to respond to that. Bob was really such an uneven businessman that the ability to, whoever yelled the most got paid. So the grant money would pay the rent. And you can't do that. Mm-hmm. Now that's verboten. And he got himself into some hot water over. He started the Lower East Side print shop when he started his not-for-profit. Mm-hmm. And they locked him out because he was uneven with the money. The board locked him out and said they changed the locks. And that was the first letter I wrote for Bob, was, why did you lock me out of the print shop? And I'm thinking, why did they lock him out of the print shop, this poor man?
Oh, man.
And kind of learn that historically, Bob was so uneven with money. If you cried, you could get paid. He wouldn't let a woman cry in front of him. You'd get paid if you brought the tears up. So as much as he gave the shirt off his back, that he was a not-for-profit, he had to have people help him a lot with the responsibility of the grant and getting grants. But what he was offering got him lots of grants. He was the only kid on the block really open the way he was open to international Black artists, people from all over, people from South, you know, if someone came in with a British-esque accent, you could be South Africa, you could be Australia, you could be British, he'd call me, and I was, my nickname was Irish. Hey, Irish, get over here. Show these people around. They're your people. And I'd show them around the studio. So I met everybody who came through the studio. It was amazing like that. Just as a business basis, it was a slippery slope of, we can't keep our doors open. I mean, there was this constant, how are we going to raise the money? And I'd say, charge the people rent who have been here for 3 years and have never paid you rent. No, can't do that. Because he invited people. Mm-hmm. He was constantly bringing people in to use the shop. Like your friend in the elevator, come to work. Well, people showed up for Bob, who sat in his office, wrote grants, and managed his money. Mm-hmm. It was amazing. He had an amazing board of artists who, you know, looked around, found him a lawyer, found him help when he needed help. But after 4 years of that, you begin to realize that I'm giving away all my labor. Bob would give me a job, and I remember working for Ed Clark and telling him I was going to charge him $5 an hour. And he looked at me like, he said something like, I can get something for $5 an hour down the street. And I said, I didn't hear you say that. And I walked away.
Wow.
And then I came back and I said, are you in or you out? You want to pay or not? I said, you know, you had my labor for free because Bob, I worked for Bob, but now you want me to audition for you. I have to charge you.
Mm-hmm.
And then he had to backtrack his stupid boyish statement. And that was the only time I actually suffered somebody's being derogatory about a woman printer.
Hmm.
Oh, no. Once I had a dealer say, are you a master printer or a... I said, don't go there. Don't say mistress printer. This is not going to work for me.
Oh,
I'm
man.
You. I am a master printer. That's who I am. So outside of that, I came from a long line of strong Irish women, and we don't even hear that. If there's nonsense going on, we're not even... I'm a worker bee. What do you need from me? I'm a professional. What do you want?
Mm-hmm.
I guess I witnessed things that I find I saw inequality, which I would just block out because I didn't know what to do about it.
Mm-hmm.
I just could do what I could do it the best I could, stand by my product, stand by my intentions, write a good contract. I learned that right off the bat, is to put it in writing what you're going to do so they can't hem and haw later.
Yeah.
Well, details. So that was... the wisdom of Sheila Marbain, who ran Morel Studios, and she printed she was Andy Warhol's first silk screener. I just love this.
Oh, wow.
In her own studio. She was a British printmaker. and she did oil-based prints, and she worked for Klaus Oldenburg. She did a number of wonderful prints. She's been dead 15 years now. But I went to her when I got my first big edition. My first job as a print studio was for Pace Edition, and it wasn't Pace Editions, it was Pace. And I was asked to do Jean de Buffet, a print for Jean de Buffet. And then it was Nevelson, and it was a guy named Ernest Trova. I don't know that he's ever emerged in the marketplace. And meanwhile, a company called Orion was giving me prints, sending me artists to work with. So they needed me. I was needed. There was more work than I had presses for. But after I printed the Nevelsons, I sold one set. I had a printer's proof set and a workshop proof set, and bought another press and brought in a team of workers. And that was 77, 78, 79.
Mm-hmm.
I looked for a press with a team of people. We were all going to leave Blackburns together. And the evolution of that look got me to a point where nobody else had income. So no, we couldn't, only I could sign a lease because I was willing. I'm backed up. My husband would back me up on the lease.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to sniff out where else can I go? And I get a phone call in the middle of that. It was the same week we were searching. It was like a week of search. I get a call from Bruce Cleveland, who's moved to a penthouse, who wants to move his basement press to a penthouse on 26th Street, the 21st floor of one of these wedding cake buildings, with a walk around, 1,000-foot walk around parapet, the top of the building. And he said, you would pay, my wife is going to be a painter in this studio, and the etching press will be in the back studio with the water. And I work a 9-to-5, so that's your shift. And for $100 a month, I had 1,000 square feet, 12 windows that were just, it was glorious sunlight.
Wow.
That's much sunlight. But another, just by a phone call, can I come see the space? And I helped him build it out. And I had my press, my studio. I had his press. And a year into that press, he came to me one evening. He would work he was a medical examiner. He'd come in at night. And he said, I'm going to liquidate. And I said, what is that? What is liquidate? And he said, I'm going to sell the business. And this little girl just in me said, what am I going to do? And he said, I'm selling it to you. And this is what I did. And I fainted. He put a bag over. I remember he laid me on the floor, went down, and he put a bag over my head. I guess you do it for the oxygen or something when you faint. Anyway. From inside the bag, I said, how much?
Oh, my gosh.
$5,000. And it's exactly what I had saved. I had earned $5,000 working at Bob's. I was a squirrel. I count every penny. I was very good at it. And that's what I had in the bank. And I bought his whole operation. Print files, glass tables, whole etching area, all the storage he had built. And he was like a Germanic builder. He just was fabulous. Storage units and cabineted doors. I bought all the glass when I moved to the studio as an entree to coming into the studio. So I inherited all this beautiful big glass. And when the building sold and quadrupled the rent, I moved to the Bowery, which was another great place to be an artist. It would be Fourth Avenue if it had a name. The Bowery near Houston, Little Italy. It's a studio in Little Italy, which I was there for 13 years.
Now, from the beginning, I know we've talked about how you've practiced like green methods and green printmaking, like getting rid of like traditional acid etching and some of these things at that time, because it's such a commonplace way to work now. It's like every single college is like as green as you can be. And like everyone's using ferric chloride and all these things now. It's such a regular conversation. But were you sort of an outlier at that time? Trying to get away from the more toxic practices?
It wasn't to get away. It was to add to the repertoire. It's to give myself options. I'm at Blackburns, and I meet a young man named Anthony Kirk, Tony Kirk, who had wanted, he stayed with Bob for about 2-3 years. Wonderful Scottish printmaker who was steeped in the tradition of Hecht, the engraving. He was mentioned as one of Hayter's, before Hayter, there was Joseph Hecht.
Mm-hmm.
There's a whole kind of animal series that he engraved. They're beautiful. Tony came to the studio at Blackburn's and said, "Where do you buy your steel?" And we were like, we don't use steel. He said, "Well, I use steel and I need to get some." And he found a place and he said, "We can get a 4-foot by 8-foot steel plate for $20. Who's in? I'll give you $2, give me a piece of steel." So I got a couple of pieces of steel. It took me 2 years to get around to figuring out, put a ground on it. You know, it's a rude surface. It's not beautiful copper polished. It's rough. It's steel,
mm-hmm.
pitted, and put a ground on it and figured out, oh, okay. It etches an aquatint without aquatint. It etches granular. Have you tried steel? Do you know it?
I've tried it, but not like thoroughly to know. I just know of all these things, but yeah, I haven't done it myself.
The studio on the Bowery was yelling distance from a roofing supply, so I could get my copper and my steel, and they would cut it to size, and I'd just go with a hand cart, pick it up, and bring it up to the studio. I could buy an 8-foot sheet of steel. So if my artist wanted to work big, full press size, which is 32-48, a piece of steel would cost him $20.
That's
so
crazy.
I built vats that fit full size, and I etched very big for the best big I could go, as big as my press bed, and etched steel. And you know how color sits on steel? Clean. Your whites are white, your yellows are yellow, your reds are red. Hmm. I got the beautiful color prints off these steel plates. And it suited that one thing that's the bottom line in almost everything I do is it's affordable. It's actually cheap. If I can afford it and or if it's free and cheap are my two favorite words. It's mine. I want to do it. So having that steel technology and making test plates, I don't mind making test plates for everything. I figured it out. I did some beautiful prints for Harriet Shore, big flowers, big tablecloths and flowers,
mm-hmm.
really wonderful medium. And you didn't know that your etching ink was going dull on the copper. You weren't aware that it had kind of mutated slightly and become duller. You couldn't get white whites, so you didn't do anything with white. Now, I would use white last and print it on top of everything because you could put like snow down or add a white layer or push things back with white. It's so hard to do any other way. Now, because steel aquatint did the way it did, I could airbrush the aquatint, put it in the vat, watch it bubble up, pull it out of the vat. I had a power spray, knock off anything that wanted to come off the plate, hair dry it quick. Don't let it rust. Hair dry it, respray it, and get an aquatint inside of an aquatint inside of an aquatint. So I had an aquatint. Someone said, "You have the shag carpet of aquatints." It was so freaking ink holding. It was amazing.
Wow.
So I could really build a very high surface for an artist to print that was aquatint, and it helped clean ink. So I was like, every time someone had a question, I'd go down that road and the steel was satisfying and it was the right price. It was nitric acid too. It wasn't a hydrochloric. It was just nitric,
mm-hmm.
which I saw as reasonably safe. But that building was up the road from Chinatown. And the lease in Hong Kong was up with the British and the Chinese. And the people who had businesses in Hong Kong left with their money in suitcases because they were afraid the government was going to eat them. So they wanted to take their money out of Hong Kong.
Hmm.
And that money came to Chinatown in New York. And those people came up the Bowery and bought buildings. My building, which was a nothing building, was sold for $1 million. The rents were not going down. Let's put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
The rest of the city had like places where the rents were going down. I had gone there because the rents were cheap and now the rents were going up. And I was like, this is expensive. this is getting more expensive, and I don't think I have the amenities that I should have for these prices. But because people were spending cash money to buy spaces, I was in a marketplace that wasn't tenable for me. So I moved to Chelsea, which was the next. I think the world was following me. It was like, okay, where did Kathy move? Okay, there must be good rents over there. So I went to the Fir District on 30th Street. And the Fir District was in decline because, I don't know if you probably don't remember any of this. The Russian fur market was collapsing. We were Russia was the enemy, and we weren't buying furs from them. And so the whole kind of, all those furriers were losing their businesses. Plus the PETA and the we don't want real fur and we're hurting animals was of consciousness raising that was happening at the same time. So the Fir District had spaces to rent. So it's an interesting lower marketplace kind of vision. This was before the High Line Studios, before the High Line went up in Chelsea, before Chelsea became the Chelsea Gallery scene. And all I could think of is, you're not going to put galleries over there. It's windy. It's near the Hudson River. Who wants to go over to Chelsea? And someone said, who doesn't have, the only people who don't want to go over to Chelsea are the people who don't have chauffeured limousines. And you put, you're right. The money's going to go to Chelsea if they build it in Chelsea because the spaces are big.
Mm-hmm. It's crazy. And it's interesting how the politics of the world influence like these movements of the art world.
It's all a kind of great milieu. The Chelsea galleries started to open, and so I sniffed it out, went over there to see what was going on, and the spaces were huge because it used to be rooms where railroad cars would take when the ports along the Hudson River, where the boats unloaded there. It all went to the Brooklyn Navy Yard, but when those box cars came in, they got onto trains inside of the buildings in Chelsea. And then there's the High Line is the train track that took that out to all the things that came from overseas, went into Chicago, went off on these train tracks. And so those buildings were going defunct because they stopped the train system and the port became the Brooklyn Navy Yard, left Hudson River and went into the East River over to the Brooklyn area. So that market change made all those buildings somewhat vacant. And so they were cheap to rent for big gallery spaces. And these spaces were humongously large. You've been there.
Yeah.
And the first people showing there couldn't conceive of putting a show up in that space. So they built inside cubicles and showed inside of smaller spaces.
Wow.
Because asking an artist to go from what was a Soho space or a gallery space of normal size or Madison Avenue, they were all smaller galleries, into these mammoth white spaces was boggling. But it opened the door to people who wanted to work mammoth, who wanted to work big. You know, Christo was doing his big sculptures. Aldenberg was doing big campus sculptures in big, you know, places. Richard Serra, great big tilted arc. There's all the outdoor sculpture is setting the tone for, you can go bigger. We can figure it out. We have an industry that can go this big. We can do spiral jetty. We can think like the size of a mountain if we figure it out.
Wow.
So the whole thing, I was approached so much to go bigger. And I said, that would mean bigger storage, a bigger press, a bigger space, a bigger rent, a bigger obligation. I will stop here. I've gone as big as I can go.
Yeah.
Because no. I do it by my own purse. I'm not a not-for-profit. I have to be able to afford it.
The storage issue is real. Yeah. When you go really big, it's like it's, you know, lots of artists want to, but
you need a community that wants to support that. Mm-hmm. You want a printer, you want a shop that can do that.
Yeah.
And then digital changed the whole scene as well.
Well, let's talk about, you've talked about collecting multiple times, and I know that was another aspect of your career that I wanted to focus on a little bit, was being an artist who's a maker of fine prints for other artists, and you have work of your own. Over time, you've talked a lot about how you collect work everywhere you go. It's almost like your souvenir when you go somewhere is a print that you find and buy somewhere. And it could be from an artist, or you've talked about you go to flea markets, you look in all these unexpected places for like little gems that people are overlooking too. Like, what's your approach to collecting, and like, what do you look for?
Okay, bottom line, cheap or negotiable. Sometimes it's about that I can negotiate for it. I can barter my work for their work. So frequently I'd like an artist's work and I'd say, I have a portfolio. Could we exchange? Most people will not say no. Like at Blackbird's, they would not say no. I lived across the street, around the corner from Blackburn's. I lived on 16th. His studio was on 17th for many years. So I would go back and visit and say hello and look at the collection and, you know, hobnob with whoever. Bob would say like, oh, but here's an Irish person. She knows about Irish people. Here, talk to her. So I had the opportunity to barter with equals, with people who felt that they were equals. Rarely did I get somebody who would say, no, this is my price range. And then I'd consider their price range, because that if that's what they thought, then that's what they thought. They should get a dollar price instead of a barter. They mm-hmm. weren't interested in collecting me. But most cases, not that I bullied them, but it was an offer that was there. And my work is beautiful, so I know that it had its own cachet of being collectible. I aimed at beauty with my work.
Yeah.
I walked through the same flea markets that Andy Warhol walked through. It's an addiction. It's part of the, it might be OCD. I'm not sure. There's just a joyfulness of setting up your morning. There was a big flea market in it. It took over a street parking at 26th Street and 6th Avenue. So I walked to work past that to get to my studio. And I would go out and I'd put $2 in one pocket and $3 in the other pocket. That was my limit, or a five and a two. Somehow I had a $6 maximum I would pay for something. And I would, when they were setting up, I would go in. I wouldn't pay to go into the flea market. I would go in with the vendors. And so they'd be setting up. They weren't ready to show me anything. And I would say, how much is this? And they'd say, are you a vendor? And I would innocently say, no. But because I was there, it would be their first sale of the day. And I knew that that carried a little bit of emphasis for their day, that if they made their sale, like before they even set up. So if they said, that's $10, I would go into my $5 pocket and look at what I had. And I'd just turn around and say, I don't have, I only have five. And I'd tear away and they'd say, well, you have five? I'll take it. They would want to make the first sale. So I knew to, without having negotiated, got the price I wanted. And I collected blue glass, small blue glass objects, because I had windows and I put blue glass all along on the windowsill. I'm still in the path. You're in my path. This is listening to your podcast. You blew me away. They're so human. They're so, I've been hungry for conversation. Mm-hmm. And it felt like you were in the room talking with somebody and I could just listen in. A lot of the collection was, I'm a printer, so they're printer's proofs. Mm-hmm. And then people who couldn't afford to pay me, I would barter. I'd say, let me come to your studio and pick something out. Oh, great. That was really the open door, that I was barterable, that my skills were, I could barter with them. It wasn't a cash flow thing. My earliest print was for one of the biggest jobs I did, took a year and a half, was for Louise Nevelson, and I never met Louise Nevelson.
Oh, no way.
I would call Pace and I'd say, okay, I need some answers to some questions. I have some aesthetic things. There's two different greens here. There's this thing. I was given collages to work from. And the secretary would say, hold on. And she'd say, could you write those questions down and we'll get back to you? And I'd be like, I have no questions. If Louise can't come and see what I'm doing, then I realized, not that I got burnt on that. That was a great starter kit to do these great big centennial prints for Louise Nevelson. They're fabulous prints. Big 13 color collages. I mean, really put me on the map, learned how to make the steel work. This is where I kind of really said, if I can do steel, I can do this at the right price. I did this at the right price. And so, but after that, I said, I don't want to work incognito, be a ghost printer or a ghost. I was a chromist. I want to be the artist. Mm-hmm. And so once I knew that that was my boundary, it was the doors were open and people wanted to work with me because I also didn't charge too much. Mm-hmm. And I serviced, I gave, you know, everybody was in Soho. I delivered to the gallery and I gave people hints on getting things sold. And I showed their work to dealership who came to my door because I was there right next to Soho.
Interesting.
It was all very, very luckily positive and fluid. And they needed a printer. They needed people like me to make plates. Pace did not have Pace editions. They didn't have a press room. All their work was farmed out. I went to where I needed to learn something and took a lesson to intern. I was an intern for Roberta Waddell at the 42nd Street Library print collection because I needed to understand what is their collection about? What is my collection about in relationship to their collection?
So being a collector like you are and a producer of some things that are very collectible, you know, some of the artists that you've had work for probably decades now, you know, in your flat files, because of like shifting viewpoints and more attention in the marketplace, a lot of artists have started getting really popular. Would you maybe be able to talk about that real quick? Just like new inquiries you're getting and things like that?
I went into the Phillips auction house this morning to see what the Ed Clarks were going for, because I printed for Ed Clark in the 70s when I was at Blackburn's. His prints sat in my drawer for this many years, 43 years. Mm-hmm. And I get a dealer from Dolan Maxwell comes and says, we want to show the Ed Clarks. We see that you've put them on your website. Well, I photographed 2,000 pieces that are on my website just by pulled them out of the drawer, got it in front of the camera. My picking of what went in front of the camera was what was readily available. I went through the drawers alphabetically. I mean, there's still a whole lot to be photographed. So the Ed Clarks came up and they're Clark, they're up first. And Ron Rumford is the dealer. And he says, he saw that they were on the website. The day I put the website up, he called me and said, can I come in and collect the Ed Clarks? Now I'd been dealing with him. He's very trustworthy. I know who he is. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, sure, if you want them. And I come in and I realize that they're at the bottom of the drawer. They haven't been unearthed for all the time I've had them.
How do you keep, just a side note, how do you keep something that long in like pristine condition? Like what's your method?
Plastic bags? It's not that crystal clear stuff with the sticky seam. I find them problematic. They're beautiful to see, but they're polyethylene bags. An artist I worked for had his third studio fire, and I realized I was very vulnerable, not to fire, but to smoke alarms going off. If the smoke alarms went off, my collection would be effed, and therefore, I better do something, and I found I couldn't find a place that I could afford the insurance. So I figured plastic bags. So all the artwork, every Christmas card, every piece has a plastic bag and an inventory tag, which in the beginning were handwritten. And each bag gets the inventory in there and a copy of that inventory goes into a box. So I'm very bean counter orderly. And as I get to them, I update the price. I don't know if you can see that. Where's my camera? Is it visible?
It's
disappearing.
Just for listeners, she's currently got an aurora borealis background, and so everything she's showing me keeps blending and disappearing into the aurora borealis. So, like we're having Skype glitches.
So I said to Ron, I don't know his current prices. I know he just passed away, and the estate is at Hauser and Wirth. So he said, I'm in touch. I will give you the consignment sheet with the prices that Hauser & Wirth has established. And I would have charged $800, $1,000 a print, which I thought was high. It had been listed in there as $250.
Oh, wow.
From the 70s.
Yeah.
And he put them at $14,000.
Get out. Wow.
Because Hauser & Wirth has the estate. And Ed Clark is one of the primo estate at auction getting the prize.
Holy
one of his
crap.
Paintings was just from Phillips, was just announced. They put it up at estimated $170,000. It's a big painting. It went for $220,000. Thank you, Ed.
Wow. Do you think like that accrual in value like literally took place over a matter of like the recent months, or has this been growing this whole time and you just haven't been aware?
The black artist market is a very niche market, and it has its own set of rules. And so when I had Romare Bearden's to sell, I went to the auction catalogs at the 42nd Street Library to look at his current auction prices, and he wasn't bringing in any money. Romare was not really valued. It's very recent. It's very recent.
All right, so let's wrap up, and we'll get into a special segment on the show called Let's Get Technical. Today on Let's Get Technical, I'd like to ask you about Collagraph, because I know that's something you've worked extensively with, and there's a few techniques and things that you employ that I think are useful. And yeah, so let's start with like materials for Collagraph. What do you like and what do you recommend people use? And actually, what is a Collagraph first? Let's start with that.
Break down the word collage-o-graph. So it's a substrate that you build up on. And then if you're not building with impervious materials, you have to seal it. So you can build with cardboard, which is a standard. It's available everywhere. Great with kids. I was fortunate to work with a sculptor who used polystyrene, which is that white plastic that they make packing peanuts with, but the kind I use is compressed and it looks like mat board. It's opaque white and it's the thickness of mat board. And I buy it in Chinatown and I buy a roll that's 72 inches long. I roll it up and I take it on the subway and it cuts like butter. It is so easy to cut. It is not a plexi. It's a buttery, soft, white material.
Wow.
And I build on that. And so I don't have to seal my substrate. And I was working with Emma Amos, God bless her. She found me a little blurb in a book from Marianne Winogur wrote a book called Collagraph Printmaking, 1972, published by Watson Guptill. And in it, there was a little 2-inch segment that was an oval image of a sailboat inside of the oval. And the sail had like what looked like staged aqua tint tonal changes. And she said, she brought me that book and she said, can we do this? And I went into my cupboard. I had curtains from my mother, old sheer curtains. And I had some styrene because I always keep it to roll on to make a rainbow roll. Said you don't have to do directly on the plate. You can do it on an alternative plate and you can cut that plate to size. And the material is very inexpensive. You have to realize cheap or free, my middle name. The material was easy to use, easy to get, easy to transport, and at the right price. It's always where I'm going to go. Use that as a substrate. I would sand it just to give it some tooth because I don't know. I'm going to work with acrylic paint on it, that the acrylic paint won't start peeling up. So I give it a light sanding with the fine 220 at the most sandpaper. Then I would paint it with black acrylic paint. Now, some people have told me they use house paint. I've not found myself successful with house paint. I buy inexpensive brand. I don't paint, so to me, it's, again, the cheapest black that they have in the store. Paint the background black just to get the even black start. Then take polyester silk screening goods, which you silk screen. Okay, so you know it comes in from very, very fine photo dot scale to rather large. So I'd buy the most fine screen before it became photo screen, because photo screen got expensive.
Okay.
So I'd buy the most fine mesh. And I'm in New York. I walked to Varick Street, which is the house. There's all these different silk screen supply houses. So I went in and got some look at samples and blah, blah, blah. And I walked away, got a sample, tried it. And then I bought, I spent $120, I remember, and I got a whole roll, a great big, you know, lasted me 4 years of silk. Because Emma, being the wise woman she was, she said, you have to lay that out on the diagonal. You can't lay it parallel to the weave, or the threads would come off the edge and would be crazy. So I had to waste that triangular trim. And so the very first silk aquatint is laid out diagonally. But it was window curtain material. So it's rather obvious dot on those first ones. But Emma did beautiful work. She painted them at home. She took them home and painted them, like put them on the easel and painted. So you paint with a white acrylic paint on a black surface. You glue it down with the same black acrylic that you use to put the background down.
It's mesh.
A very, very loose black acrylic. And it doesn't leave any marks. You want to use it loose enough so that you don't see any of the application brush strokes.
Okay.
You want the painter, the artist, to be the painter to make the image. So you get an anonymous black surface that the artist paints with white paint. She can go from a wash to an impasto paint, whatever her choice.
Okay, so I see.
You
so
can't you can't remove, but you can add.
So you're building the first base plate before you like make any art with it. Is this sheet of polystyrene that you said, just like hard plastic, like thickness of mat board, and you paint that black with a thin black so that because you're trying to control like the brush strokes because that'll all print later, right? So like you don't want to inform the material and the surface before the artist gets to it. So then you apply the sheet of screen mesh or silk over the whole plate, like the whole plate is covered?
Yes.
Yeah.
It actually, I would put it beyond the plate.
Okay.
And push pin it to a board that's underneath to kind of keep it from when you go to brush it on, it wants to squirt you around.
Mm-hmm.
So to keep it kind of stationary, I would pin it down.
That's a good idea. And so then you have just like a big plate that like if you were to print that in the very beginning, it would print like a full aquatint, right? So the whole plate would wipe up
Beautiful.
And hold
and
a ton of black
even.
Ink. Yeah.
And no discoloration because there's no oxidation.
Mm-hmm.
So the colors you use are the colors you get. And it's very ink holding. So it's very rich.
And so then when you...
You like velvet black? We can give you velvet black. Very inexpensive.
That's awesome. And it's so much simpler than trying to like time out like an etching when like a bath can change, you know, that an etching bath can change heat and you don't know it. So you're always having to check it.
It's acrylic paint. It's all plastic. And the resilience is you can pull an addition of 250. It doesn't show wear.
Wow.
It's extremely resilient.
Hmm.
It doesn't wear out. It's magic. It has all the things that steel was giving me as a, you know, inexpensive, work large, true color. And the artist could, I would mail things away to people, mm-hmm. sent them in the mail, and the artist painted them and mailed them back. And I could proof by mail. And they could just paint. All they had to do was think about what they wanted to paint.
Wow.
So it really was, thank you, Emma, was the new door that opened. So when I moved to a studio that had no water, I had a backup. I had Colograph.
Mm-hmm.
So all my artists were introduced to Colograph and they were like, why didn't you do this before?
Yeah.
No, I was an etcher before. That was the trade that I sold, was my ability to do the chemicals, to be in the chemicals, to use the airbrush, to do acid, to know the timing, to make the test clean. You know, I was very trustworthy in my abilities with the old world tradition of acid.
So for Colograph, you can print it like intaglio, which is where that silk aquatint would come in a lot
of
handy.
Yes, very rich. It eats ink. Be prepared to use ink.
And like you can also roll it relief so you can print multiple, you know, the interior surface and the top surface.
To me, the people who finesse Colograph are people who are actually drawing with collage material.
Hmm.
They build like brick buildings or they, you know, they do imagery. People who do imagery with Colograph are the ones that fascinate me. Because otherwise, it's kind of like a high school project, mishmash.
Yeah.
A bunch of fabric. It all starts looking high school, generally. I tend not to teach it because the starter kit everybody looks kind of the same. They glue down, you bring them a bag of goodies and they mishmash it down. And I have a rule, you can't go thicker than a dime. That really makes them upset.
Yeah.
Measure everything. Okay, here's a dime. That piece of lace is much too hunkamunka. Let's not do it. It'll just hold too much ink. It'll look gross. Mixographia, you mentioned. They are fabulous.
Mm-hmm.
There. Those people they've masterminded something. I'm in love with that story.
Oh, yeah. Tell me about it.
It's beautiful work at the fair. And they, the first time I saw them, I think they had Louise Bourgeois red string, things with red threads in them. Oh, mm-hmm. my God. They're so beautiful. And they're willing to share. They have a video on their website of them working. I mean, it's God bless.
Yeah.
So there's, you know, it'll keep going that way. There's people who reinvent some portion of what they can do and do it superbly.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's wonderful. Yeah. I encourage people to try new methods and try things like this, because it's definitely like underexplored, I think. And there could be ways to make something really unique in today's world using some of these lesser used techniques. You know?
Well, you said something about printing on a handmade piece of paper, and you kind of gushed oh my God, it's so wonderful. That depends on the paper.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What handmade paper were you printing on? Because a lot of it, because I had access to New York Central and could buy a paper from anywhere, the paper would range. The handmade papers had a lot of range.
Well, yeah, I found...
I have a handmade paper story. Can I tell it?
Sure, yeah.
Your time?
Yeah.
I was working for Sarah Brayer on a print where if you use a watercolor brush and water on white, let's say Moriki or some kind of white cottony Asian paper, you can, where you wet the paper, if you pull the paper away, you'll get something with a fibrous edge. So mm-hmm. she was making clouds and tufts of snow that went into her picture. It was an aqua tint of the Brooklyn Museum. Snow had fallen in the front of the Brooklyn Museum, and she did an aqua tint of it. And then we had to put snow on everything in these little rice paper things. And the paper needed to be tinted because the white wouldn't look so white. So we used a Richard Dubois from Canada, from a Canadian mill in Montreal. And they had a gray paper with a little tiny white, what they called a fly speck, the name of the paper translated fly speck paper. And she had started with a handful of this paper, and then New York Central Supply was selling it. They ran out. And we called up to the mill, and they were out. They were sending a supply. We didn't know how long it would take. And Sarah had to leave to go back. She lives in Japan. And it was like, we're not going to be able to finish this edition while you're here. She said, no, I'll go to Dudenay. I'll go to the paper mill. Paul Wong was around the corner. And she brought him a sample of the paper and said, make us this paper. So he made a gray substrate with little white flecks, but all his white flecks puffed up like little tiny cotton balls. They were puffy. And the white fleck in the Richard Dubois paper was very like a paint chip, kind of much smoother, much finer. And we were scratching our heads, and he sent over three samples. She had three more days. We had to finish this edition. We started calling around, does anybody have Richard Dubois, kind of Sam Flax? There's all these stores that carried hand paper. Nobody had it. Well, a friend comes who's an artist I print with named Kathleen McFall comes. I'm in from Montreal today. I thought I'd come by and visit. Kathy, I'm so glad you're here. She said, oh, I see you're using Richard Dubois. I used to work for them. We're like, do you have a number? Can you call? She said, sure. I said, find out what the white speck is in their paper. She calls up, it's cigarette rolling paper. We call up Paul Wong. We say, tear up some cigarette rolling paper. He did. He had it the next day. He dried it out overnight. We had our paper. Oh my God, in the path of the possibilities.
Wow.
It's freaking amazing.
Kathy, I wanted to thank you for making time today and for joining me on the Printcast and telling your stories.
You know, the part where I know interviewing people is a hook. It's a really special hook. People want to talk about themselves, and now I'm on the other end. I love it. Thank you so much.
Thanks for tuning in to my interview with Kathy Caraccio here on the Printcast. Tune in next time to hear from Linobill Fick. We get into all kinds of talk surrounding his love of, well, lino printing. So, yeah, it's going to be awesome. I love Linobill. Thank you to Kathy Caraccio for coming on the show. Thank you for her generous amount of time. She and I spent a lot of time putting this together. like many hours of free game conversation. And then the interview that I cut down was from like 2.5 hours down to what you heard today. So it was quite a battle trying to pick and choose like what the most valuable moments were. But I think we arrived at like a really good episode today. So give Kathy a follow on Instagram at Kathy Print, and that's KathyPrint, and online at kcaracciocollection.com. That's KCARACCIOCOLLECTION, kcaracciocollection.com, where you can view a huge catalog of her work that she's published over the years. Kathy's published a number of really important artists, from Louise Nevelson to Emma Amos, Romare Bearden, Ed Clark, and like they're phenomenal works. Like honestly, they're huge standout works that, especially now today, like are receiving a whole lot of attention and a whole lot of like art market interest. So that's really good and really cool. And so, as always, also you can find information about the podcast on theprintcast.com. As I mentioned too, you can support the Printcast on Patreon for as little as $3 a month at patreon.com/theprintcast. Thank you for listening to the Printcast. I really appreciate all of your time. And I have to say, despite being only the 14th best podcast about printmaking in Slovakia, in my heart, I'll always know.
This is the Printcast, the best f***ing podcast about printmaking ever made.
You've been listening to the Printcast, a podcast about print shops, the artist, the process, and all the things we make. If you like what you're listening to, help us get the word out by subscribing and leaving a 5-star review and sharing with your friends on social media. You can find the Printcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, as well as on the website printcast.com. Music for the show is by Jazar. Voiceover provided by Jim Birdsall and Rhiannon Birdsall. Take care of yourselves and each other, and we'll see you again on another episode of the Printcast. Bye for now.